Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone. This is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I am coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine, and it is so important that we are in your large intestine today, as always, but in particular because Constantine and I randomly got on the subject of endotoxin today because I had to tell the long story about my eczema on my toe. I got carried away and definitely went down a rabbit hole, but we introduced the endotoxin subject, and I've had Kiran Krishnan on my show in the past, who is a microbiologist who almost everybody knows, and he talked about endotoxin a couple of times in my few episodes, and I think I'm going to have him back because I think we need to dig deep into endotoxin. Even though Dr. Ray Peet talks about it at length, I think it'd be great to talk to a microbiologist about this and really get into the weeds about it. But I think Constantine and I do a really good job of picking at it, and he explains some very interesting facts about it and kind of how it can be at the root of so many issues that we have. At the very least, it can be worsening these issues, like my eczema on my toe. Anyway, we talk about a lot of different subjects, but it all kind of centers on endotoxin. So enjoy.
So I have increased my fruit intake like dramatically, right, in the last few months, probably 3 months. Or how long have you and I kind of been chatting? Probably maybe even more than 3 months.
More than earlier than May. Even as late as like April, March.
Wow. Okay. So 4-5 months.
The truckers were in January or February, right?
Oh, wow. So maybe
a long time ago.
Wow. Time is just flying by way too fast. So, okay. Well, I'm just going to tell you my little story about my foot thing, which I think I'd mentioned to you before. So I had started going to this plate fit class in January, which was just like this 27-minute workout. And you know, you can modify it. So I felt like it was really good for me because it wasn't too intense. It could be if you make it intense, but I was just really modifying everything. And you have to wear these Pilates socks, these toe socks. They're like gloves for your feet, and they're cut off, right? So they kind of roll down a little bit. And I was doing this like these twisting moves. This is a lot of useless information, but maybe it'll be useful. I don't know. And I have like notoriously really clammy hands and feet, like just really, really always moist. And I know that's a thyroid thing. What it does is it keeps my hands and feet really soft. Like they never, never callous. They're like baby feet. And so when I'm in this class, I'm like twisting my feet and the sock cut the inside of my big toe, my right big toe and the first toe. It kind of got itchy and it kind of got a little, I felt like it got infected. And then my husband's like, no, I think it's like athlete's foot because you cut your foot and the bacteria got in there. And then it got really bad, like itching crazy. I was doing methylene blue. I was doing providone iodine. I was doing bleach. I was soaking my foot in every possible thing and nothing was helping. The only thing that was helping was Benadryl. That's it. And I got nervous about taking Benadryl all the time. So I would have to choose between really, really itchy toe and like Benadryl.
You took it orally or on your foot?
Orally.
Mm. It would just try on your foot? Maybe you should try a liquid Benadryl on your foot. They sell liquid for kids. So
really?
Yeah. Well, and even they have little sprays for when you get a bug bite, people spray Benadryl on the bug bite. So you could just buy that spray and put it on your foot and see if that does help, then clearly there's some mast cell activation issues.
And so, but like, isn't it still being assimilated the same way, the Benadryl, or it's not? Like, I'm worried about the brain effects that Benadryl might have over time. I'm asking this and telling this long story because I know a lot of women in the group And I know a lot of clients, they take Benadryl for a lot of reasons, to sleep. They take it for histamine responses. They take it for mast cell activation. They take it for all kinds of stuff. And some of them take it almost daily or every night. And I feel like, I mean, I wasn't doing that, but I was definitely taking it during that time. And I thought, God, well, I hope this is not doing something to my brain.
I don't, yeah, so Benadryl is very similar to the antihistamine cyproheptadine, which, when we have that Georgie episode or even your next episode with him on serotonin, he'll definitely be talking about cyproheptadine, because it's a classic antihistamine, anti-serotonin, anticholinergic drug. And so they're basically the same. Benadryl's, they're not the same, but they're very similar. The difference is Benadryl you can buy over the counter. The thing with those drugs are they do make you really sedated, so I don't think they're good daily, just because you don't want to be sedated during your day. But I don't think they're bad in any other sense, like long-term effects, other than the fact that you'll just be sleepy during the day. I know they're actually used like very therapeutically for things. And again, Benadryl and cyproheptadine are different, but George even has some blog posts like 12 milligrams of cyproheptadine for 2 weeks. Don't quote me on the length, but let's say 2 weeks, like reversed liver cancer or something like that. Like, so they're
Wow.
very,
That's
very
the
therapeutic.
anticholinergic effect, would be that, or like reducing the mast cell activation, which of course is going to help reduce or help deal with the cancer.
Oh, this is the actual title. Cyproheptadine 12 milligrams daily cures patients' metastatic liver cancer in just 2 weeks. Like, that
Oh, I
just
remember reading that.
resembles, it's a very powerful substance because it lowers those things, serotonin, histamine, acetylcholine. And serotonin and histamine are both produced from the mast cells. It's not, mast cells don't just produce histamine, they also produce prostaglandins. They produce lots of things. So cyproheptadine is very good at kind of suppressing that overaction. And I'm not sure if acetylcholine comes from mast cells, but cyproheptadine does block acetylcholine. And that's why Georgie calls cyproheptadine an anti-estrogen, because like we talked about in our first episode, by cyproheptadine blocking histamine and acetylcholine, effectively means it's blocking estrogen, because those two are how estrogen kind of
Wow.
does its thing, right? So that's like
Well, let
his
me
take
write
on it.
down questions for Georgie right now. So that would be like, why not take daily? Like, what could be what side effects?
There are some side effects. So, like we talked about acetylcholine in our first episode, and that makes you like having too much, has lots of symptoms, and one of them is lot of saliva production, right? So, and not just saliva, anything mucus. You could have really mucusy nose, you could have really mucusy mouth, which means lots of saliva. You're always
Could be nausea.
nausea, but yeah, and those are the other things. But in terms of like mucus, there's lots of fluid production, like saliva and mucus. Well, if you take cyproheptadine or Benadryl, which are anticholinergic, both of them, too often, you're actually, the anticholinergic part is actually making you produce less saliva. So you could be way thir more thirsty, right?
Dry eyes, dry
Dry
eyes.
eyes, dry like lips, dry tongue. Maybe if you're doing it chronically, like for months, if you're really, really lowering saliva production, that could have an effect on the teeth. Like if the saliva is needed for like, enamel,
pH.
yeah, pH, the gum health. That's like something I'd be thinking of, but that's not going to happen in even like 2 weeks of daily use. And you're not even using it like, how much Benadryl are you even using? 25 milligrams?
Yeah, just like the over the counter little. And
Yeah.
sometimes I was just doing like a quarter or a half of one
And here's
just
the thing
because it
with,
would take
yeah.
the itch off,
And here's the thing with the Benadryl. Taking too much could actually increase serotonin instead of blocking it. And serotonin excess is what causes hallucination. Anyway, and there's a lot of kids that I guess in 2020 were I never saw a video of this, but I heard people talk about it, where kids would drink bottles of Benadryl and like hallucinate for
Oh
fun.
my gosh.
Yeah.
Like the
But
Tide
yeah.
Pod challenge.
And that's not because they were low, yeah, like the Tide Pod challenge. Wow, the youth. Anyway, drinking a whole bottle of Benadryl is probably hundreds of milligrams of Benadryl, maybe even 1,000. So obviously they've reached the serotonin threshold where now they're hallucinating. LSD, lysergic acid, I forget what the D stands for. At very low doses, actually lower serotonin, but just like Benadryl, at very high doses, it increases serotonin. And people take
Interesting.
LSD, like they call it acid, right? Lysergic acid. They call it acid, and they go, "Oh, are you tripping on acid?" Right? Because they're hallucinating. Well, they're taking a massive dose of LSD, which makes them hallucinate. If you're hallucinating, if
That's
you're
right.
seeing hallucinogens, if you're seeing things that aren't real, it's likely due to serotonin. So if you're taking a drug that causes you to do that, probably from serotonin, which is weird. And I don't know if everything that lowers serotonin increases it at higher doses. I'm not sure if that's like true for everything, but it is true for LSD. It is true for Benadryl. So Georgie's recommendation is keep it under 50 milligrams of Benadryl a day. And, a normal cap is 25. So you could take two a day and you're still pretty safe. But if you took 100, 150, you drank half a bottle of Benadryl, you're probably in the like 300 range.
Yeah, and
Which is
that just
not good.
sounds crazy. Well, you know what's interesting is I took melatonin. I stopped melatonin when we met, just because, and then also because Keith Littlewood, Tomo, was like, yeah, he doesn't really recommend melatonin because it's not addressing the real issue. But I hadn't taken it in a long time, and I took it. I started taking it again, and I took it, and I had a Benadryl, I think half a Benadryl and some melatonin, and I was tripping. I'm so sensitive, it's nuts. I mean, it was like half a 25 milligram Benadryl and like probably 25 milligrams of melatonin. And I went to bed, and I was in such a state of like w not euphoria, but some kind of weird, not a comfortable place. It was weird. So something happened, that maybe raised my serotonin in that way with the
Yeah.
combination.
So the way I see it, I'm not super well versed in melatonin stuff. So if someone has some good reason for taking it for some certain issue, I mean, I'm not gonna be super opposed to it. I wouldn't do it myself unless I was really convinced, but I'm not gonna if someone tells me they're taking melatonin, I'm not necessarily gonna freak out and tell them not to. I think a lot of people like this lady, Doris Lowe, who talks about vitamin C. She also talks about melatonin. I think she's making both of them pretty popular. So she's a fan of melatonin, as an example. But anyway, the way I see melatonin, and obviously there's more to the story, but this is my view. It's one of the ways where our body can get rid of excess amounts of the serotonin. And the serotonin is the thing, right, that's causing lots of issues that aren't desirable, right? And we can go over a whole list of them. But anyway, what happens is you have the serotonin. One of the ways it's you get rid of it is by turning it into melatonin, right? So it's kind of like a, how do I describe it? It's a way to reduce the serotonin, right? Because you're turning into something else. But if you take melatonin, then, I think the idea is, well, now you're preventing the serotonin from turning to melatonin, because if you already have enough melatonin, then you're not really turning this excess serotonin you have into melatonin because you're already supplying it. That's like the story I've heard. So, because melatonin comes after serotonin, right? When it's time to sleep and it's the lights are off and everything, the serotonin starts turning into melatonin. So that's kind of the idea. It's like you want to be producing a bunch of melatonin at night for the reason of
Clearing.
your, yeah, you're like, you're, it's the building block is serotonin. So you're like, oh, it's a way to use the serotonin instead of having it float around in your bloodstream, right?
So serotonin is a neurotransmitter, right? It's not a hormone.
Yeah,
And
neurotransmitter.
melatonin is the hormone. So, I mean,
Well,
I take it. What?
no, yeah, it's melatonin comes from serotonin, so it's,
But it becomes a hormone from a
yeah.
neurotransmitter. or
Noradrenaline.
does melatonin act as both? Like GABA is a
Yeah.
neuro.
Well, it's, a lot of times it's hard to distinguish between, because the thing with hormone, it's such a general term. Like, obviously there's steroid hormones, which are made from cholesterol, like progesterone, but then there's like peptide hormones, where they're made from proteins. Like, for example, and then obviously there's neurotransmitters, like dopamine is made from tyrosine, right? Thyroid hormone is made from tyrosine. T4 is tyrosine and four iodines, right? T3 is tyrosine and three iodines. Dopamine, you need tyrosine to make it. It's an amino acid. Serotonin, you need tryptophan, all right? So these, hormone, neurotransmitter, right? They are different, but when we're talking about these ones, we're talking about the ones that need the specific amino acid to make them.
Okay.
Thyroid, dopamine. They're not, dopamine and thyroid aren't the same, but they're both made from tyrosine, right?
Got
But
it.
estrogen isn't made from some random amino acid. It's made from cholesterol, right? So, they're different types of hormones. I'm not sure exactly where melatonin would fall there, but I'm sure it's related to serotonin just because it's comes
It's
straight from serotonin, right?
not a steroid hormone, right?
No, it's definitely not a steroid hormone.
Okay.
No. Definitely not a steroid hormone. But
Well,
like, for example, sorry, one last thing. Like, allopregnanolone is a neurosteroid, right? But it's from progesterone. It's still a steroid hormone, but it's a neurosteroid. It's not really, it's for the brain, right? So
Right.
that's like one example of a metabolite.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. And there's so many layers of endocrine education knowledge to like it's just very complex. I personally in my Dutch test, I have really low melatonin and have for a few years. That's why I take it. And but that's interesting, the concept behind, well, you know how I mean that's why they call it one of the master antioxidants in the body, along with glutathione, right, is melatonin. They're saying, and you're probably hitting on that right now by saying, yeah, because it's helping clear, like an antioxidant would, it's helping clear out certain toxins, and maybe spent serotonin is one of them, maybe. I don't know. I'm guessing. Probably shouldn't even be talking about this because I don't
Yeah.
know.
Yeah, I don't know too much. Yeah, like I said, like I've never really focused on melatonin, but I know a lot of people love it, and then a lot of people don't like it. So it's one of those things, and I happen to fall on the side of not taking it, but I also don't, like, for
I
me,
know it does it downregulate your own production. I mean,
that I
people will
don't think.
take it. People will take it because they don't, they are not making it like me. So I don't care if it downregulates my own production because I don't make it anyway.
Yeah, I don't really care. I'm not care, sorry. I don't think it does the down regulation thing. I think a lot of people assume almost anything you take will that's endogenously produced will lower
Yeah,
the
hormones
synthesis.
particularly.
Well, hormones, but even like digestive enzymes and
Oh,
stuff,
right.
like
Yeah.
people say, oh, you take 8-hydrochloric acid, you'll not produce it. Like, that's just, I
Yeah.
don't think that's true. I'm not going to say it's definitely not true. Like, how do I know? But I don't think that's true, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, it is true for some things, like testosterone. It's definitely true. If you take testosterone, your body as a male, your body will produce less. But that's not the case for progesterone. It's not the case for pregnenolone. It's not the case for, I don't think it's the case for melatonin. But it might be. But I don't think it's like, oh, if you take melatonin, you're not going to produce it. Like, that's just a given. I don't think it's clear cut like that. I don't think
Yeah.
that's how it happens. Yeah.
Well, so let's go back to what I was saying about my foot because it leads into something else. So, okay. So then the Benadryl was helping, but I didn't want to take too much. And then we went to Sarasota and for the 4th of July, and I was in the ocean there almost every day. No, for sure every day. Sometimes twice a day. The water in Sarasota is like a gigantic float lab. It's just like so mineralized and so ultra salty. And within like one or two visits to the beach and then putting my feet in the sand, my foot was completely healed. I was going every day. My skin was soft. I was just, the humidity there was tremendous for me. It was just like, I was blissed out. I felt like I just had reached the next level of health in Florida. And so then we come back, and then, like, I don't know, a couple of weeks later, I feel my foot itching again, and boom, it comes back full force. So finally, I go to see a dermatologist. Dermatologist is like, "Oh, you have dyshidrotic eczema." And I'm like, "Really?" She's like, "Yeah, that's exactly what this is. And you need these three creams to kill it." Because I had been using something Charlie had to try to kill it, and it was helping a little
What are the creams? Like, it's not
bit.
like a cortisone cream, right?
I mean, yeah, there's some. Hang on, let me grab them. Okay, so one of them, this one was a sample. Thank goodness she gave me two because it was like $75 for a tube of this stuff. It's called Eucretia, and it's a chrysoboral, chrys, chrysa borele, chrysoborele. No idea what that is. Chrysoborele. And then there's miriposin, mipurocin. I've heard of that before. Mipurocin. One's an antibiotic. Bethamethasone dipropionate. No
I
idea.
don't know any of these.
I know. So anyway, she's like, "Yeah, you can't just kill it with one thing. You got to use these three things, and one is an antibiotic." And so, sure enough, like within the first couple of days, it was almost completely gone. And then 2 weeks later or so, it's still like there's one spot, right? That I just feel it, and I'm just like, it makes me crazy. So I start looking up dyshidrotic eczema, and the triggers, or I should say, the things that worsen it, were, of course, they said gluten, dairy, sugar, citrus, fruit sugars. And I was like, "Are you kidding me?" So I got this thing. I exposed my skin to this particular type of bacteria. I got this eczema, and then it wouldn't die. And I was thinking, is that because I'm having my intake of orange juice and fruit is so much higher than it used to be? And so this brings us into the whole carb conversation, right? Because a lot of women in the group are like, I love Kate Deering's suggestions. I love repeat suggestions. I just can't do it. I don't care how high quality the milk is. I can't do it. I get bloated or stomach aches, or I get mucus. A lot of people get like they feel like sinus inflammation when they drink dairy. And then a lot of women are like, it flares up my candida when I drink juice and eat fruit. And so they're like, I can only do low glycemic berries. And so I'm like, now thinking that I need to take a break from the orange juice. I used to not be able to drink orange juice. I used to get respiratory congestion when I drink orange juice. And for some reason, I haven't. But I'm like, is that what's going on here? Is this like triggering, keeping this dyshidrotic eczema alive because it's actually my gut? Something's going on in my gut
Yeah,
and the fruit
so
sugar,
well,
right?
first I think yeah, first I think well, this kind of there might be more evidence that you might have some issues with your gut, like maybe an overgrowth of some type, because well, one thing is what Benadryl can help is I know Georgie does think that eczema and different inflammatory conditions can be at least partly caused by what's called TLR4 activation. So it's toll-like receptor 4. And that's basically, you know what endotoxin is, right?
Sure.
Yeah. And so
Well,
you're
let's
just
talk
for
about
your,
what that is for the audience.
yeah. So for your viewers, endotoxin is basically the outer shell, the outer part of gram-negative bacteria. And if you have an overgrowth of bacteria, and it could be positive, gram-positive or gram-negative, but endotoxin specifically means, for the gram negative, it's also called LPS, lipopolysaccharide, if you're researching it. So anyway, they just call it endotoxin, but that just basically means it's a result of bacterial overgrowth. One of the things endotoxin does it activates, this part of the intestine's toll-like receptor 4. It's called TLR4. So anything that does that can cause various issues from eczema to arthritis, like pain anywhere in the body. And beneficial things are TLR4 receptor antagonists, things that block that receptor. The best thing to do, though, would be to not have bacterial overgrowth so you're not constantly activating that receptor, because then that activation of the receptor could be the reason you have your arthritic knees or whatever, whatever. So clearing out the gut is the first thing to do. But if someone said, okay, I want to block the receptor at least now, while you can't just get rid of my overgrowth right now, like in one day, well, there's many of them, and some of them are very common, but one of them is Benadryl. Benadryl is a TLR4 antagonist. Vitamin D is, Imodin is. Imodin is found in aloe vera juice, it's found in the Cascara sagrada bark. Glycine is a TLR4 antagonist. Naltrexone, and I think naltrexone is used for like getting over heroin and opiate addictions, like because it blocks, and part of the reason is it blocks TLR4. I know it does things with the opiate receptors or whatever, but
Yeah.
people use naltrexone for like low dose naltrexone, not like heroin dose. Now, heroin recovering doses of naltrexone. They use low dose naltrexone for serious gut issues like bloating and all that stuff, because probably partly because it's a TLR4 antagonist. So that's probably one major reason why the Benadryl helped you. It's antihistamine, great. It's anti-serotonin, great, but it's also blocking TLR4. So if it is helping you because it's blocking TLR4, it's like, why is your TLR4 upregulated? Why is it being, poked, kind of thing? And maybe a lot of women say, I can't eat fruit or whatever, because they already have a bunch of bacteria and their digestion is poor. So just more food that couldn't be used to feed bacteria is causing even more of an overgrowth. Or maybe they didn't have an overgrowth, but they had poor digestion. So when they added food, like they ate like a apple, and now that apple skin is feeding these bacteria and they're growing in their overgrowth. They're in the small intestine, there's too many in the colon, and they're hitting these TLR4 things, they're getting into the bloodstream, causing all these issues, and eczema could be one of those. So, and it wouldn't be the fruit's fault or whatever. It wouldn't be like, and there's things that are more likely to be feeding these bacteria that would lead to overgrowth, and that would be like bread and starches are more likely, especially starch without fat, because fat can kind of be like it protects the starch in a way from being, because a lot of fats are antimicrobial, like in coconut oil, right? So if
Sure.
you eat stuff cooked in, like, let's say you eat French fries fried in coconut oil, I'm not necessarily suggesting that, but if you ate them, like they
Careful.
probably, yeah, that people can gain weight on those, because that's going to be a lot of fat
It's
in one
also
kind of thing.
PUFA.
Well, no, coconut's not PUFA, it's
Well,
really saturated.
but if it's heated to boiling temperature, it becomes a PUFA, doesn't it? Doesn't it oxidize at that point?
It doesn't become a PUFA, but almost any fat can be damaged by excessive heat. Yeah, but coconut, especially refined coconut oil, is probably the safest fat there is in terms of its ability to withstand heat. So it might be okay. If you're pan frying, cut potatoes on a pan with coconut oil, it's probably fine.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I wanted to briefly interrupt and remind you about Just Thrive spore-based probiotics, and I wanted you to listen to a quick clip of Kiran Krishnan, the celebrity microbiologist, talking about how important a diverse microbiome is and spore-based probiotics.
And the biggest issue with the allergies and all the crazy sensitivities, when you look at the prevalence rate of peanut allergies and environmental allergens, and the fact that asthma is now among kids is a pandemic, all of these things are because of the loss of oral tolerance. The loss of oral tolerance means that what we used to be able to do is take in huge amounts of different, proteins and antigens and things that people would now be allergic to. The immune system would be able to sample it. The bacteria within your gut would be there to help the immune system figure out, this is something you need to attack and this is something you need to leave alone. That's the process of immune tutoring. And that is lost when we lose the diversity in our microbiome.
Thanks for listening to Kiran Krishnan. If you want to use your coupon code HGG20 to get 20% off, just go to justthrivehealth.com and check out all the great things they have. And now back to the show.
But your point was that if you're eating like a French fry that's been fried in coconut oil, the antimicrobial.
Or let's just say pan fried in coconut oil, okay. Not deep fried.
Like deep fried.
Not deep fried.
The antimicrobial effects of the coconut oil will be beneficial to.
Just because you're going to help prevent that actual, you know, what is potato, right? It's the type of carb is starch, right? And that starch can easily feed. If you have any bacteria in the small intestine, my opinion is that's too many. Like the small intestine should be sterile. You want, obviously, bacteria in the colon. The bacteria in the colon produces B vitamins like B12, and it produces, you know, it helps convert K1 to K2 in the.
I mean, we're meant to have like 3 to 5 pounds of microbes in our gut.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's minus whatever's in the, well, also your upper GI and your lower GI, but not your small intestine.
Yeah. So my stance is, yeah, your large intestine should, which is also the colon, right? Should have bacteria, but not too much, because if it has too much, because there's a limit for everything. If it has too much, then the lower part of your small intestine can start, they can start going into that basically. And now you have all this bacteria in the small intestine that shouldn't be there. And that's, you know, people like talking about SIBO, right? Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. I think probably any bacteria in the small intestine would be a SIBO, right? Yeah. Not just like, oh, you should have, you know, this amount of billion, but you kind of went too much. Like, no, I just think the small intestine is where the food is digested, the nutrients are taken up by the villi, the little hairs, right? And then you take the waste and put it in the colon, and then the bacteria do their thing in the colon, in the large
intestine. Right. That's so interesting too, because that's really makes sense why probiotics have started this, you know, epidemic of like SIBO, because these probiotics that people are buying, even the fancy ones, they're not getting past, if they get past the stomach acid, they're making their way into the small intestine and they're not getting any further.
And they're colonizing yeah. I don't know why I said it so weird. You're colonizing the small
colonizing.
Intestine. You're colonizing the small intestine. So, and that's not good. I mean, no. If you had some beneficial strain of bacteria and you got it to the large intestine, right? That's great. I think, if you had a need for more of that strain and it got there and it did its things, and let's say that strain started producing, you know, vitamins for you and helped your vitamin K1 turn into K2, like, okay, then that would be really beneficial.
Yeah.
But if you're taking a bunch of probiotics and they're like taking up a, you know, residence in your small intestine, that's not good. And
yeah,
almost, and people like to blame carbs, but you know, almost anything you eat, Well, I guess it's mostly carbs, but like they like to blame carbs because, oh, it makes me bloated. But I mean, if you're bloated and you just ate, like you're probably, first of all, really low metabolic function, because that was our whole first episode on why does thyroid matter? Because every step of the digestive tract, you need enough energy to do it. You need that quick gut motility, because even if you don't have bacteria in the small intestine, like if that potato you ate is slowly moving through the small intestine, it's just asking to be fed on by bacteria, and they will grow if they feed, right?
Right.
So you want it to go quickly. That's one. And if you're hypometabolic, you're the peristalsis, like the literal movement of the small intestine is slow. Like that's bad. If your stomach acid isn't high, then you're not, you know, more bacteria are able to pass through it. And you know, that's not good. You're not producing enough digestive enzymes, because starch needs amylase to break down. If you're not producing enough amylase, it's not getting to the meal in the small intestine, then it's going to go to the large intestine, not being fully digested. And then the bacteria that should be there will proliferate. There's too many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of the small intestine as an end, so the end is the beginning of the large intestine or colon, and the start is like, let's just say after the stomach, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have overgrowth anywhere in it. If you have the overgrowth at the end of the small intestine, then your colon is probably too populated and they're spilling over into the small intestine. If the top of your small intestine is bacteria is there, your stomach acid is probably not high enough and bacteria getting into it from there. And if the whole thing is filled with bacteria, then you need to deal with that quickly. And I
Yeah.
mean, I think that's why people really like monolaurin, and they feel better on antimicrobial things like monolaurin, because they're clearing up the small intestine. But what's a natural way to clear out the small intestine? Bile that we produce. Bile will clean the small intestine. It's an antimicrobial for the small intestine. And monolaurin, and usually fat-based things like that, like monolaurins from coconut, right? Lauric acid, it's a fat, right? A fatty acid. These are primarily used in the small intestine, they don't necessarily get to the colon. So if your issue is you have a lot of bacteria overgrowth in the colon, you need something that would,
Okay, let me so shameless plug for spore-based probiotics here, because that's what's so cool about them is that they're actually in a spore. They don't open until they know where they're meant to be, and then they get past that small intestine and get past the stomach acid, and then they get into the colon and they open there and then they do their thing. So that's pretty cool. That's why I like Just
And
Thrive.
the big benefit of, like, people might be saying, what does that mean, do their thing? Well, part of the do their thing is some people say the spore-based probiotics actually produce their own antibiotics. So they're coming in there and they're killing the overgrowth of the bacteria that shouldn't be there, at least in high amounts. Because any bacteria is a bad bacteria if there's too many of it. There's too much, right? Someone could be, oh, I love Lactobacillus reuteri or whatever. Like, if you have too much of that, it's bad.
Dose
But
makes the poison.
yeah, well, yeah, for some things, right? And this is one of them. But the spore-based, some people say they get there, they produce their own antibiotics in a good way. It's not like, no one should think this is like, sterilizing their large intestine, but it's coming, they're reducing an overgrowth, a potential overgrowth in the colon. But also some people say a lot of their function is just like they're competing with the other one, so then they die from the competition, the overgrowth. But
Competitive
either way,
inhibition.
yeah, either way, spore-based probiotics are thought to, you're not really taking them to increase your gut flora, you're actually taking them to decrease an overpopulated large
To
intestine.
normalize
They're
things
like an
too.
antibiotic, right? It's the opposite of why someone would take a probiotic. So it's good. It's good if the
But then
listener
the
was
other
listening.
thing, so then you know, that's why a lot of people can't do fiber, because they'll eat fibrous foods and they'll get bloated, they'll get stomach aches, some people will get horribly painful belly aches from fiber. And so that is because the fiber is not accompanied by fat, or it's not accompanied in a way that is useful for the large intestine, and those oligosaccharides, or whatever you want to call them, are having a problem, and they're feeding the endotoxin. And so that's why the carrot salad is so great, right? The repeat salad is because the carrot, it has undigestible fibers, but it's also got antimicrobial, antibacterial, antifungal properties. So when you eat the carrot salad, it helps to feed the microbes in there, like the estrobilome, but which helps eliminate toxic estrogens, but it also reduces endotoxin, doesn't it?
Yeah, so the distinction here is like soluble versus insoluble fiber. So the soluble fiber would be more like beans. Beans are really high in soluble fiber, but there's almost never going to be something that's other than like pure cellulose, right? If you buy like plant cellulose, that's insoluble, but there's never going to be like one natural plant that is only insoluble or only soluble. But for our purposes, let's just call beans soluble fiber. They're very, and some people really like beans and they say they have a lot of health benefits, and I don't doubt it, but in a really compromised gut, in a overpopulated small intestine, beans are going to be like prime food for them. You eat them and they will feast, the bacteria will feast on those beans, like the soluble fiber and stuff. Same with grains and oats and stuff like that, but beans are probably like the top of the list of like bacteria feeding things, right? And obviously that's not what you want if you have a lot of bacteria. But the carrot salad is different. It's more insoluble. And think about a raw, hard carrot. It's, first of all, it's already kind of antifungal and antimicrobial because it has to exist in the ground and not be eaten by bugs and stuff. So it's already in bacteria. So it's already kind of naturally like that, the skin of it. But also the big thing is we want these fats like olive oil or coconut oil and vinegar and things. We want them to do their antimicrobial job. But if you just have a spoonful of coconut oil, it's probably digested at the very top of the small intestine. Like it's not even, it's so quickly absorbed. But when you have it like soaked into the carrot, the idea is that the carrot will bring it all the way through the small intestine and into the colon. Mm. So you're able, the carrot by itself is great. And the carrot, think of it as a brush. We talked about this bacteria and the endotoxin on the bacteria, you know, tapping that TLR4, that toll-like receptor 4, causing all these issues, including eczema and whatever. If the carrot, if you think of it as like a literal broom, like sweeping the walls of the small intestine, getting rid of that overgrowth. So the carrot's acting like a broom, which is great. It's also acting as a medium for the antimicrobial olive oil or coconut oil, vinegar and salt all together. That's why the, you know, the, all of them together, it's symbiotic. No, it's, they're working together.
Yeah.
So the carrot salad's great. And you're not just a broom, you're actually bringing that coconut oil to the colon, right? Not just leaving it in the small intestine, that kind of thing. So that's why it's really good. Charcoal, activated charcoal is kind of like a similar idea. It's this insoluble thing that you're not going to digest. And the idea is you take the activated charcoal and it's just like the carrot in the sense that it's supposed to sweep up. It adsorbs, so it doesn't absorb with a B, it adsorbs with a D. So it like adhesive, things will stick to it, right?
Did
so
you
it's,
make that up?
No, it's true.
That's cool. Adsorb.
Adsorb.
It sounds like
yeah,
a name of an alien. This
yeah,
is
yeah.
Adsorb.
And everyone thinks you're saying absorb,
right?
But it's adsorb. So the charcoal, think of it as like the carrot's a broom, but the charcoal is really a broom. It goes through and will literally just grab these things, these bacterium, and it will go even to the colon, and it's not digested. You're not gonna, you know, it's not gonna be digested at any point. And then you should see it in your stool, like you should poop black basically from the charcoal. And the idea is you take the charcoal to clear out these bacterial overgrowth. The charcoal, you know, indiscriminately adsorbs the things, grabs things, so it's going to you know, if you take a vitamin supplement or whatever, it's probably going to grab that. If you eat food, it's probably going to grab the nutrition in the food. So people say to take charcoal, it's really inconvenient, but like 2 hours before and after you eat, so you need a big 4 hour window there,
right?
But I'm not saying anyone needs charcoal. I'm just saying charcoal is useful because it acts kind of like a really intense carrot. But yeah,
that's, a really intense carrot.
Yeah, for the purposes of sweeping up the gut.
Yeah. What do you know about immunoglobulin A? And, you know, it's getting very popular and a lot of companies are producing these products that have IgA. And, you know, it's meant to be like immune boosting, immunoglobulin, like, I was trying to do some research about, you know, they're like antibody producing, do you know anything about it? Antibody
no,
blood protein. So there, Just Thrive has a product and so does Microbiome Labs has a product. And I think it's like people have deficiencies of this. It's immunoglobulin is an antibody blood protein that's part of your immune system. Your body makes IgA and other types of antibodies to help fight off sickness. Having low IgA deficiency means that you have low levels or no IgA in your blood. It's found in the mucous membranes in your respiratory system and your digestive tract. It's also found in saliva, tears, and breast milk. And a deficiency seems to play a part in asthma and allergies. Researchers have also linked IgA deficiency to autoimmune health problems. These are health problems that cause your body's immune system to attack your body by mistake, blah, blah, blah. We know that's not true. But as far as the body attacking itself by mistake.
Is this something that people say like colostrum increases?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay. So that's the only time I've heard it. I've heard people
yeah
mention it when they talk about colostrum.
I
mean,
well,
I think colostrum is good. So
I was researching it because you were talking about allergies and stuff, and I'm wondering if you had tried it, and also wondering about so complications of a deficiency of IgA, diarrhea, sinusitis, bronchitis, eye infections, ear infections, pneumonia, autoimmune disorder, skin infection, asthma, allergies. But I was trying to figure out if it does anything for endotoxin. It would seem that it does, but
Well, all those issues sound like things that endotoxin can, or just when I say endotoxin, just bacterial overgrowth in general can cause, right? So,
yeah.
but I
Oh,
think
right.
it's
It was
also, sorry, go on.
IgA against gut-derived endotoxins. Does it contribute to the suppression of hepatic inflammation and alcohol-induced liver disease? It was a super interesting study. So I don't know. I think it's the next big supplement on the scene, but
Cool.
thought I'd mention it to you because you were
Yeah.
asking about allergy stuff and yeah, and endotoxins. So I always get these things sent to me for free, which is cool. So I'm trying
Well,
it.
yeah, if it helps with the endotoxin issue, maybe it's TLR4 antagonist, maybe it just literally lowers the like sheer volume of bacteria that contain this endotoxin, right? Because the endotoxin is the shell of the bacteria that causes all the irritation. But I just want to say a lot of gut issues stem from gut irritation, and a lot of the time you can assume that's from overgrowths, because all those bacteria, they're overgrown and they're causing this irritation, causing the toll-like receptor 4 to be activated, all these things. But anything gut irritating can do that. So if someone's constantly eating a food that's irritating their intestine, this can also activate TLR4. You can have a sterile small intestine, but eating something like an unripe mango is not ready to eat. An unripe mango should cause great stomach pain. And this pain isn't just hurting your stomach. When you're that mango, that think of it as like a poisonous mango because it's not ripe yet. It's a it that sour taste, right, is indicative of like shouldn't eat it if it's like a fruit. That shouldn't be sour. Like a mango should be very sweet, kind of soft. But if it's a hard, sour kind of thing, as it's going through your intestines, it's activating all these inflammatory pathways. It's activating these endotoxin receptors. It's activating all these issues, and you can have like arthritic issues or eczema issues or anything endotoxin related just by having something irritating your intestines. So when people eat fruit, it's very important that they eat, you know, ripe fruit that's ready to be eaten, and not because don't just say I'm eating a pineapple and it's good for me, because you might be a person that even if the pineapple's perfect, you might the pineapple just might really irritate you. Some people have like really itchy and numb and sore tops of the roofs of their mouth after eating
Yeah,
pineapple. They
sometimes
might
I
be
get that.
slightly allergic to it, right? And if you're eating pineapple or drinking pineapple juice daily and it's going through your whole GI tract causing issues every single step of the way, that's obviously not good. And
Yeah.
anything could irritate the stomach. Like a lot of people's supplements can do that. You might be thinking you're making yourself healthier, but you have a supplement with like talc or titanium dioxide, and that small amount of titanium dioxide could be enough to mitigate the benefits of the supplement. Maybe not, but if it's causing huge gut irritation, you don't even need the bacteria there, right? You can be right. So
Yeah, it's a lot of times where
people
people
have to
can't.
realize what they're, you know,
Yeah.
allergic to or sensitive to, because if someone, when people, when you talked about dairy, if people are eating A1 dairy, right, that A1 casein can very well can be irritating the intestines, causing issues like the
So tell us
mucosa.
the difference between A1 and A2.
Well, in the I think the practical takeaway of that is the there are cows that in their milk have what's called an A1 casein, and there's cows that have an A2 casein, and they physically look different. Like the A2 cows will have like a hump on their back, like they look physically different. I think Italian cows and like Southern European kind of cows will pretty much always be A2, but then like British cows, American, Canadian cows, they're very like A1. They have a very flat back. You can see them, so oh, that back is completely flat. There's no big hump, right? So they look different. And the type of protein, the type of casein protein in the milk is different. And the A1 is like an opiate, and it's kind of like gluten. I think that's a really easy way to think about it. A1 casein in A1 milk, think of it as something similar to a gluten effect. And gluten, obviously, people know that, you know, you don't need bacteria in your small intestine. If you have gluten, that gluten can, what's it doing? It's messing up your small intestine. It's causing irritation. That irritation could immediately lead to the brain issues, the brain fog, the arthritic knees, eczema. And people say all the time, gluten causes arthritis. Gluten causes, well, A1 casein, think of it like gluten. It has similar effects. They're both opiate compounds or something like something specific like that. But the thing is, almost every other animal that produces milk, like goat, right, sheep, that kind of, those are the main non-cow milks. They're always A2, always. So people I know that do really well dairy completely switched from any A1 to only goat, and they don't have to look for A2 goat, just buy goat. It's always A2 or A2 cow, and they do way better in terms of like not being sick from milk, like with gut pain or even, you know, things that aren't related to the gut. Because like we said, drinking A1 milk or eating gluten could come up as painful knees. Like it doesn't have to be my stomach hurts, right? So you have to be careful what you eat. And for some people, it's best they never have gluten, which means never having wheat, which some people would say, oh, I want my pasta. Maybe you could try corn pasta. I don't know. At least it doesn't have gluten. That's one example. But in terms of milk, I think it's a really easy switch around. Buy goat dairy. I know people that eat sheep cheese, goat cheese. They drink goat milk. They drink A2 cow milk. They eat A2 cow cheese. Even if you see grass-fed organic milk, if it doesn't say A2, just assume it's A1, and you might not be doing yourself favors.
Some people might think that they're lactose intolerant, and they're not. They're casein intolerant.
They're A1 casein intolerant. Yeah.
And you're just completely off the charts. Any milk or dairy. So any
milk protein I cannot have. Whey, casein, doesn't matter. A1, A2,
the goat.
Casein. Yeah, goat. Because dairy has specific casein and whey. Those are the two milk proteins, right? A1 and A2 are both casein. They're just different types. And one's more like gluten. But I just can't have protein from dairy. Just like some people can't have like shellfish, right?
So I always thought dairy only meant cow.
No, goat milk is definitely dairy, camel milk, like almost any animal that.
But it's called dairy. I thought it meant, I for some reason I thought dairy meant.
Oh yeah, goat cheese, cow. Feta cheese from Greek people, you know, Greeks.
No, I mean the word dairy. I thought referencing cow milk.
No.
But it can mean any kind of milk.
Any type of dairy. Dairy.
Any type of milk.
Yeah.
Any type of milk is dairy. Okay.
Yeah, like
except for oat milk.
Yeah, no. Well, that's
ever since I had Leo on, I always make oat milk jokes in all of my podcasts for some reason.
Really, yeah.
Okay, so then talking about you were talking about beans. You know, it's interesting because like my husband eats beans and he can't tolerate them at all. He can't digest them, gassy, bloating, painful belly. I can eat beans. I love beans. I mean, I always have to soak. If I make them, I soak them. If they're like mung beans, I sprout them. And, if they're like canned beans, I recook them. So I strain them.
I boil them. Yeah.
Then I boil them. And then, and I don't have an issue. Now you made it sound like across the board beans aren't great for you, are good for you, but, the bean protocol in support of the liver, and then the amount of sulfur. I think it's one of the highest foods in sulfur, like top three highest foods in sulfur, which we really need for all of our sulfation processes, you know, in our hormones and in making glutathione and all that. So what do you say about that?
Yeah, I didn't want to mean I think beans are across the board bad. I just wanted to say that they're, you know, in someone that has bacterial overgrowth, they're one of the most likely foods that will lead to the proliferation of more of those bacteria.
Okay.
That's all I meant.
And that's
I think
fiber in them.
Yeah, it's, right? It's just how they are.
Yeah.
They're really easy to feed the bacteria. And because some things are harder to feed bacteria, almost everything can feed bacteria, but like raspberries are harder to feed bacteria. Raspberries are not optimal food for bacteria as beans are. Like, for example, raspberries, like they're slightly antimicrobial, especially their seeds. Like people always talk about tannins and stuff. Like the tannins are actually antimicrobial. So unless there's a huge overgrowth, that raspberry is probably not going to be feeding, you know, pathological bad bacteria too much, because it's not just like food for them. It has different chemicals and issues that aren't really suited for that. And there's some people I've listened to that have even gone on to say that fruits like raspberries and mangoes will actually feed the bacteria that's beneficial to us and will kill or not feed the bacteria that's bad for us. I don't know how.
I've heard that too.
You know, I'm not going to like make a stance on that, but I mean, that sounds pretty cool to me. But beans, they're just like this starchy kind of soluble fiber filled food that's ready to be eaten by these bacteria. So your husband probably needs to like clear out the gut a bit with carrot salad, or maybe even an antimicrobial substance such as like an oregano oil or a monolaurin or something. But monolaurin, I get like, would only be useful if it's like the upper small intestine. If your husband's is more like a colon centered thing, the monolaurin would be very
right
not useful. But I mean, he could eat the take the monolaurin and eat the carrot at the same time. Maybe that'll help bring it down. But beans aren't bad, but if you bloat from beans, you probably shouldn't be eating them until you fix your
Well, so it depends for me. It depends on which, like I said, if I don't boil them and stuff, I will too. But so it makes me think once again about my little dyshidrotic eczema friend, and thinking about my issue is probably not bacterial overgrowth, especially with all the gut health work that I've done. I have a feeling that it is candida, which is why the sucrose and the sugars from the fruit seem to overgrow it. And I know this fact because my tongue is whiter when I eat more fruit. So I think that I still have a systemic, that's not the right word, but an intestinal overgrowth of candida due to probably heavy metals. I think that's something that showed up in my hair mineral analysis a long time, forever. And I have done a lot of work on that, but I think if I had to guess about what issues that my gut is dealing with and why this little eczema patch has shown up and why it seems like the citrus and the watermelon and everything this summer has worsened it, or has not worsened it, but not allowed it to heal, I would have to say that there's probably a candida overgrowth. And this is really common in the group too. Super common. What do you think?
I mean, yeah, if the candida is in the small intestine, or like SIFO, like small intestinal fungal overgrowth, that can be causing your issues too. It doesn't have to be specific to bacteria. But yeah, wouldn't beans also feed the candida similarly to the
bacteria? I guess because the beans are starch.
The starch is broken down rapidly. So the sugars are, there's monosaccharides, which means one sugar. There's disaccharides, which is a combination of two monosaccharides, two sugars. And sugar is sucrose, which is a disaccharide. It's a two sugar containing molecule. It's a glucose and a fructose. Glucose and fructose are both monosaccharides. Together, they're a disaccharide called sucrose. There's galactose and there's lactose. So lactose is glucose and galactose. Both monosaccharides together, they become a disaccharide, lactose. Starch.
What about oligo?
Oligo is, I think, a type of starch. Oligo is a type of, oligo is more than two.
Okay.
But starch is basically, starch is a type of oligosaccharide, I think. Because starch is basically a long chain of glucose. So when you digest or you break down a bean, bread, potato, rice, it's starch. And people say, well, starch is different than sugar, but And that is true. It's not a sugar. It's a complex carbohydrate because it's starch. But starch is basically, let's say there's, this isn't true, but let's say there's 10 rings of glucose in a bean starch, right? I don't know the number of rings, but they're all made of glucose. Once you digest it, the rings like break apart. And now that bean starch has just become lots of little glucoses, right? So that's, starch isn't that different. Well, it isn't different than glucose once it's broken down. That's the kind of thing.
So you're saying, like, wouldn't starch feed it just like the watermelon and stuff?
Yeah, like I don't think it would be only specific to bacteria. I think the whole sugar candida thing is a little overblown, especially because really easily digestible fruits and sugars, like especially watermelon, which is mostly water and, you know, some other things, it would probably be digested rapidly at the really top of the small intestine, and then just kind of, you know, vitamins and stuff, the vitamin C would be absorbed throughout the other parts of the small intestine, then it's in the colon, the large intestine. And like, I don't know if that candida would be really, you know, blowing up because of that. And I also don't think this, I know you're not saying this, but I don't think the solution to like candida is starving it of fruit and like sugars and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do have a candida thing, like I'm not opposed to like getting rid of it with, but you've already tried things like monolaurin and other things, but you can
and high doses or
antifungals.
This is an interesting conversation because we're touching on a topic that we're not even meaning to touch on, which is that, you know, we're so good as humans at like, or maybe it's just like habitual, maybe good isn't the word. We're just like really, it's such a habit of us, of ours, to try to connect the dots and figure out what's wrong with me. You know, like Charlie says in his office, like when he's working on people, the number one thing that they talk about besides what kind of pillow should I use is why? Why did this happen to me? What's happening? Is it because of A, B, C, and D, or did this happen, or what happened? Like people are obsessed with trying to figure out how they threw their neck out, right? Same thing like with us, like obsessed. Why am I bleeding so much? Why do I have breast cancer? Why? What did I do? What was the sequence of events that led me up to have this thing? And yeah. I think that's good, but I think it's also, it's a double-edged sword because, for example, you just pointed out, like, I'm like convinced that it's candida and convinced that I have this overgrowth and you can't tell me different, right? I get onto the Facebook group and I'm like, there's absolutely no way I can do fruit sugars because I have a candida infection and I know because my tongue is white. And that's like the reason, right? And it's almost to a detriment. It's almost to a fault because the fact is I have been eating fruit, a lot of fruit since you and I first started chatting. And I only used to do berries and bananas. That's it. And now, I mean, especially this summer, I've just really done a ton of it. And like, maybe there's also the issue of overdoing it. Like you can overdo everything.
I guess it would overdo would depend like,
like orange juice.
Yeah. Orange juice. You could definitely overdo. There's lots of things you could overdo. You can overdo fats for sure. Like people, especially oils, like an olive oil, everyone's like olive oil is great. But if you're adding lots of olive oil to something, you're not really measuring it. Like you can definitely be adding too much olive oil to things, too much butter to things. It's really easy to overeat fat. It's also really easy to overconsume juices, like orange juice. It's just, you just drink it. And if you're drinking it so quickly and you're not even like tasting it, it's kind of just like water. In the sense that you're drinking it so quick, so you don't even know how much you're drinking, especially if you just came back from walking, you're sweated a lot, you know, you were sweating and you're parched, you're thirsty, and you, instead of water, you pour orange juice, like you're probably not really like sipping it. You're just, you drink a whole glass in a matter of seconds, right? Like, so yeah, obviously it's very easy to.
And the citrus, there's the citrus component to that. What are the disadvantages or the negative effects of too much citrus?
Yeah, like I said, anything that irritates the intestines will cause all these issues. And, you know, too much of the citrus can probably Because that's like, you know, different chemicals, right? And I don't mean like pharmaceutical chemicals or industrial chemicals. Like, you know, every type of fruit and food will have these different chemical compounds, right? And these too much of, you know, oranges can probably lead to stomach irritation, especially if there's citric acid added to it. Because if it's added, the citric acid is coming from like a mold, a fungus, instead of actual, you know, orange citric acid, that kind of stuff. Georgie talks about how lots of drinks, milks, juices, they add silicon dioxide into it, and he describes it as powdered glass. So I know it's not technically powdered glass, but he calls it powdered glass. So imagine powdered glass going and causing millions of little cuts in your small intestine, right? If your juice has silicon dioxide, if your milk has silicon dioxide, it's not the juice, it's the powdered glass ripping up your intestines, right? That's just an example. But so obviously it's safer to eat like a full orange or a full peach or a full apple or a full mango, because you can tell if it's ripe. You feel it, you cut into it, you see it, you're tasting it, and you're like, is this sour? Is it sweet? Is it hard? Like a mango shouldn't be sour. It shouldn't be hard, right? An apple, you know, should taste a little sweet. It shouldn't be green if it's supposed to be red and you bite into it and it's too hard to bite into, right? You're like, it's easy. And frozen fruit is usually pretty ripe when they pick it and then freeze it, because then it would taste bad and there's issues like that. So I think frozen fruit, like frozen strawberries, I love those. You can look at them, they're bright red, and you know, you're ready to go in a smoothie or something. But juice can be useful for lots of things. I know lots of people talk about fruit juices, but they can also be super allergenic, especially orange juice, unfortunately. It doesn't have to be the silicon dioxide. You could, if the juice is made with sour oranges, oranges that weren't ready to be juiced, that sourness, though the chemicals involved in the sourness, like the naturally occurring, but the chemicals there are meant to kind of keep you from eating the fruit because it's not ready yet. And that'll tear up your gut. So, I mean, fruit isn't like devoid of issues, right? But I do think if people are eating, I think it's almost impossible. If you have good, ripe, you know, non-pesticided grapes or something, try to eat too many. Just keep eating them. I don't think it's possible. Just eat bowls and bowls of grapes. You'll be fine, right? But if you drink grape juice, like you could drink a gallon of that stuff. It's very, very sweet. It tastes great, right? So I don't think fruit's a problem as long as you know how to deal with it, right? Like, don't force yourself to finish that peach that's so sour in your mouth. Like, you know it's gonna mess up your intestines, that kind of thing.
What about why does Ray Pete say pulp orange juice with no pulp?
Oh, I think it's because the pulp would be feeding the potential bacterial overgrowth in the intestine. That's what I think the main idea is. Yeah. But he's a fan of eating oranges though. I just don't think and I think he thinks the pulp orange juices are probably less. I mean, I think he's cool with fresh squeezed orange juice, but I think if you're buying like I'm not sure about this, but I'm assuming he thinks the pulp in carton orange juices are harder to your digestive system to work with. They're probably lower quality or something like but he does like eating oranges and he likes marmalade. He always talks about marmalade because he thinks the orange peels are very beneficial when cooked and stuff. So, you know, marmalade is like cooked oranges with the peel. So it's like a super repeat food because it's filled with narinogen, which is an aromatase inhibitor, anti-estrogen, right? It's, you know, apigenin is another one. Where do you find apigenin? Chamomile tea, guavas, parsley. So, you know, these narinogen and apigenin are things Ray always talks about. And that's one of the main reasons he likes oranges and marmalade.
Nice. I should make some marmalade.
Yeah. Danny has a great recipe.
Oh, he does? Oh,
Yeah.
cool.
Let me just read these melatonin comments. I know that was a long time ago, but I finally found my things. So he goes,
Who goes?
Ray goes, and the melatonin was apparently a signal for suppressing fertility during the stressful winter. That's taken out of, you know, that's just one part. But anyway, I don't want to read the whole paragraph. And then another one.
Interesting.
Sir O'Token found that that in 1994, that melatonin inhibits progesterone production but stimulates estrogen production, and is widely recognized that melatonin generally inhibits the thyroid hormones, creating an environment in which fertilization, implantation, and development of the embryo are not possible. So,
wow.
Cyclical exposure to melatonin can have an effect on the reproductive system opposite to that of chronic exposure, and the way exogenous melatonin is delivered to the animal can have unexpected effects on the actual amount of melatonin circulating in the blood. The actual amount of melatonin in the tissue, its relation to normal cycling of the animal, and the influence of temperature are often disregarded in melatonin research, making it hard to interpret many of the publications. And he goes on.
Oh, I wonder why it's called the one of the master antioxidants, though.
Well, he talks about that. He says, you know, I'll just read that then. There's a lot of talk about melatonin's function as an antioxidant. And by the way, this paper was written, I think, like 15 years ago, maybe 20. So that's funny. You're talking about this. But like so many other antioxidants, in quotes, melatonin can act as a prooxidant at physiological relevant concentrations. Some studies have found that it, like estrogen, increases the activity of pro-oxidative free radical nitric oxide, which acts like melatonin on pigment cells, causing them to lighten. The promoters of estrogen are also making claims that estrogen is a protective antioxidant, though that isn't true of physiological concentrations of estrogen, which can catalyze intense oxidations. The market culture seems to guide most research in these substances. And the last one, there's more, but I won't read the extra ones. This last one says, almost any kind of stress increases the formation of melatonin. So, and he writes a lot more. This is his article on aging eyes, infant eyes, and excitable tissues.
Wait, hang on. Okay, so if it increases the production of melatonin, if stress increases the production of melatonin, is that what he said in the end?
He said,
almost any stress.
Almost any kind of stress increases the formation of melatonin. Yeah.
So that sounds like a good
stress
thing.
Response.
It sounds like it's right, but
well,
it sounds
it's also like
it's...
if someone has high melatonin, it's probably due to a stressful situation, like a.
Yeah, because sometimes I do see people's Dutches and their melatonin is really, really high. I mean, it sounds like it's a lot like all the other hormones. Like it needs to be opposed. It needs to have control, but it's necessary. It's what drives DHEA into the eye to help us with our circadian rhythms and to make, for healthy eyesight. And it's like, so we know we need it, but like, having low levels or undetectable levels would probably be bad. And having too much would be bad, just like all the other hormones. It's not like a bad guy. It's just you got to be careful when you're supplementing it.
Yeah, but something that, you know, inhibits progesterone production, stimulates estrogen, and generally inhibits the thyroid is probably something I would be wary of taking on a long-term basis.
Yeah, for sure. For sure that, but it also begs the question, what does one do when they're low? And is that something that stores in the tissues the way estrogen does? You know what I mean? Is it a bad guy in that way?
They're good questions. I don't know enough to.
Who's like, who are those good questions it. For? Is that a Georgie thing?
Oh, I'm sure he would know lots. He'd probably just know anything you'd have a question on related to the human body.
Right. Okay, I'm writing it down for him so I can use that.
But as it stands, it's not something I would take personally. But yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, that's melatonin. But...
Well, that's good. This was good stuff. I feel like this was really good stuff. Important information that I think a lot of people have questions about, especially people that have eczema and skin stuff, you know, and endotoxin and like, you know, feeling like, because I, as a healthy gut girl for years, would always recommend fiber, you know, make sure you're getting fiber. Yeah. And there are companies like Just Thrive and some other companies that make fibers that are specific to helping clear endotoxin. Just Thrive's prebiotic is specific to that. Mm. And so it, and I still recommend that. But And people, I never hear people get, you know, bloated from.
Well, in your serotonin episode with Georgie, he will certainly talk about endotoxin, because 90 to 95% of serotonin is actually produced in the gut. And, you know, with people, let's just say the average person has too much bacteria in their small intestine, they have bacterial overgrowth. That's going to be leading to way more production of serotonin. That can probably be a reason why people would have too much serotonin. So when you talk to Georgie about this neurotransmitter, he'll probably bring it up and probably say one of the best ways to make sure you don't produce too much, since 90 to 95% is in the gut, you would kind of clear out the gut. So and by clear out, I don't mean sterilize like to unnormal levels. You just want to be where you should. No bacteria in the small intestine, not an overgrowth in the colon, just the right amount.
Yeah.
Right. So he probably will say, if you said, George, if you're on the thing talking to Georgie and said, Georgie, what's the best thing to lower excess serotonin? He probably wouldn't even bring up a drug. He would probably say activated charcoal, because the charcoal would help get rid of the bacteria which are causing the serotonin.
Interesting.
Excess. So you'll definitely talk about gut issues on your serotonin episode, because they're just the same thing. They're related intensely. Yeah.
Right. You know, there's a product that Premier Research Labs has called MediClay FX. And it's a binder. It's like bentonite clay, but rather than like completely removing, because bentonite clay can actually like strip minerals. It like really goes in and like strips, like really, like you were talking about broom, but even more like just like vacuums, you know?
And you know, bentonite clay is also an adsorbent, just like charcoal with the D.
Yeah.
I think binder just means adsorbent.
So what MediClay FX does is it's a calcium donor, which is interesting because it makes you wonder if it's a good thing or a bad thing. Dr. Marshall always used to say it's a great thing, but it makes me wonder, like, you know, do we want to be what kind of calcium is it donating? And do we want to be taking on that calcium in that way? You know, it's interesting, but I just thought about it because it's a product that I used to use a lot. It's great for when you eat out at restaurants. You take a capsule and you open it in water if you're out to eat somewhere, and it like, it's like a sponge. It like goes down and it like helps absorb like all the garbage that's in takeout food and restaurant food. And Dr. Marshall would be like, never ever have or if you're having like commercially grown produce or whatever, because you're, you know, staying somewhere and you don't have access to organic food, he would just like take MediClay every day. And it's not going to fix everything, but it's going to help eliminate and absorb those things to help, you know, get it out of the body. So it's a pretty cool product.
Yeah. And I mean, and there's things that you can do to just increase gut motility, so you're dumping things more, because if you're constipated, obviously that's bad, because then you're, you know, backing things up, and then you don't want to proliferate the bacteria and grow if you're constantly not going to the washroom, you know, frequently enough. And that's why Ray always talks about that Cascara Sagrada aged bark.
Yeah.
Not only does it have Imodin, which blocks TLR4, very potently anti-inflammatory for the intestinal wall, so you can actually open it up, but it also helps relieve constipation. So
it's a laxative. So like
a different than Senna though. Like they act differently. And aloe vera juice has aloe Imodin, so that's another option for Imodin.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap it up, I just want to talk about that real quick, which is like, you know, for years now, for 17 years practically, I've been talking about digestion, and people say, well, how can I speed up my motility in my gut? And I always say, well, are you digesting what you're eating? So if you aren't, if you're seeing it in your stool, you know, you can do a few things. If you're seeing what you eat in your stool, you can take digestive enzymes, you can chew your food better, you can slow down when you eat, you can take hydrochloric acid, you can, if you can take hydrochloric acid, you can take spore-based probiotics. But one of the main things that I never talked about until I met you, which is that the bigger driver, I don't know, bigger, they're probably tied for first, right? The bigger, the one of the biggest drivers to constipation and slow motility is hypothyroid and is a sluggish thyroid. And people are like, I've had my thyroid checked. My doctor says everything is fine. I don't have hypothyroid, or I'm on levothyroxine. I'm fine, thanks. And then it's like, well, these subtle changes, and Danny Roddy talked about this yesterday, these little subtle things, your thyroid can be reading perfectly fine to everyone, but those little subtle sluggish moments that might be a pattern, maybe it's not sluggish all the time. Maybe it's sluggish middle of the day and after you eat and stuff like that. That's going to have like a really strong effect on how you digest, how you get rid of the waste matter from that food, and what happens while that food is in waiting, right?
Well, thyroid's probably, it is probably the biggest one, because if you think of thyroid, as we've talked about it in our previous episodes, just about, you know, optimally functioning metabolism, which means optimally functioning metabolic functions, which means optimally functioning energy production, then every single step of the, you know, digestive tract, the digestive system, every single step of the whole human body function requires energy, requires this metabolic energy, metabolic function to work. So, you know, slow gut motility, low stomach acid, low digestive enzyme production, like all of this, all of these are symptoms, and very likely symptoms, of low functioning energy production, right? So if you're not producing energy effectively, then yeah, your stomach isn't producing enough acid. Your pancreas isn't, you know, there's not pancreas, spleen, maybe, whatever the main organs are for digestive enzymes, I think is pancreas. They're not, you know, producing enough amylase. They're not producing enough, you know, all these things, right?
All the ases.
Yeah, all the ases, all the digestive enzymes, they're not producing. You know, your stomach is not your stomach. Your intestines are slow. The gut motility is low. You're constipated. Like, so, you know, every like metabolic function is probably the top, because if someone says their issue is they don't produce enough stomach acid and they need to take betaine hydrochloride, I'd say, well, the reason for that is probably, well, not necessarily, but hypothyroid people do produce less stomach acid. They do produce less stomach digestive enzymes, right? So yeah, that's always,
well, sometimes though you can have, I mean, it's what came first, the chicken or the egg, right? This is where the Morley people get a little cuckoo, is like, I think they forget the outside impact on things like a Lyme disease, for example, you know, or just like emotional, like someone who is like a first responder or who has emotional trauma in their life, PTSD, or has a heavy, heavy stress load, you know, that alone can impair your ability to digest your food. And yeah. So then does that then have an effect on your thyroid, or was it the stress that slowed down the thyroid that slowed down the digesting? Right. So like when you're in when you're on your emergency hormones, you know, you're going to eat something and it's like loaded with magnesium and all these macro and micronutrients, and you can't uptake any of them. And
yeah, well, that's definitely true, because you can't digest effectively if you're not in a parasympathetic state. If you're eating on the go and like rushing and all these things, you're in a sympathetic state, so you won't be digesting. So yeah, that's definitely true. Like you can, you know, I guess have a good TSH, good total cholesterol, good pulse rate, good temperature, but eat while literally like running to work or to class or school or whatever, then yeah, you're not really going to be digesting that food, because you do need to not be in a sympathetic state to break down that food. So that's
definitely. But most likely it's the other way around. Most likely they've been in that fight or flight state for so long that they've downregulated thyroid function, liver function, gut function. That's most likely.
Exactly. That's the point. Cause like, yeah, anyone could acutely increase stress and sympathetic state by like running or rushing. Like anyone can do that. But if you don't have to run or rush to be in a sympathetic state. You can, or high stress hormones, you can just be living your life with very high adrenaline and high cortisol, which is antagonistic to, you know, the good way of producing energy, not the stressed adrenaline way of, you know, liberating substrate and making energy and all that stuff. So yeah, you don't, someone shouldn't listen to this and say, oh, well, I'm good. I'm just, you know, I rush too much. Like that's, you know, acutely could be that that's why that day you didn't digest food that well. But if you chronically have bloating and chronically have diarrhea or more likely constipation, diarrhea is probably more of like a bacterial infection, bacterial overgrowth. Constipation is more like, that's more of a clear sign of hypothyroidism as compared to diarrhea. Mm-hmm. Bloating is pretty common, right? All these digestive issues, gas, right? Yeah. Cool. Well, we didn't even talk about how to eat carbs, but I mean,
I think this was good. You know, I mean, endotoxin, I feel like is, you know, I think we could talk about endotoxin a lot more, and I'm sure Georgie will get into that, but, you know, it's like, it's important stuff to talk about. And people are like, well, I'll just eat the carrot. And then they don't talk about all, you know, they're like, oh, I just can't even stomach all of that. The vinegar and the oil is so gross. And I'm just going to eat the carrot. It's fine. They say that all the time. And, you know, they don't understand all of what you just explained. Yeah. Which is,
and the other thing, the other option of carrot is like the boiled white butter mushrooms. Like
people, oh, man. I just shared that from Andra today. I should Andra's read great. It. I should read it just so people, in case they missed it. So she's sacred button mushrooms, blocks excess estrogen, definition of, oh, and here's a good one. Definition of aromatase, right? People, we hear that word thrown around all the time. And here's the definition of aromatase. Increase estrogen conversion via aromatase, which is an enzyme which converts androgens such as testosterone to estrogen. So people are like, oh, when I take testosterone, I get fat, I get hairs on my chin, I get whatever. And they don't realize that that's not the testosterone. It's you aromatizing testosterone into estrogen. And white button mushrooms are clinically confirmed to stop, aka inhibit that action. So it stops the aromatization, protects against neurodegenerative diseases. 3 weeks on white button mushroom supplemented diet decreased lipid oxidation in the brain and all inflammatory markers related. It also increased antioxidant effects of catalase and SOD. People can read this on wellness.by.andra on Instagram, or you can go into the estrogen dominant support group and see it because I posted it there. But phytochemicals in the mushrooms, aqueous extract inhibit the aromatase. And she goes on. The vitamin D2 from mushrooms improve bone health. And that's really cool because, you know, I used to think white mushrooms were like not very nutritious at all. I never would get
them. They should definitely be boiled though.
Right. So that's what I was just going to say. That's a
really important point. Yeah.
Yeah. Is boiling them for like, what, 5 minutes and then straining them. And the garbage that comes out of those mushrooms is shocking.
The water turns very black, very dark.
And then there's stuff in it. There's like a lot of stuff in it, like little tiny bits of debris and stuff. And it brings out the flavor of the mushrooms a lot.
What are they called? The umami?
I think that's really yummy. Like just so good to cook with eggs or just eat with some butter by themselves. They're so good. Yeah.
So the thing is, so Ray Pete definitely recommends what people think is an excessive amount of time, but you know, his recommendation is like 2 to 4 hours of boiling, right? So that's a lot more than 5 minutes. So people,
there'll be nothing left.
No, trust me, they're there.
You've done that?
Oh yeah, but
I mean, I've done it when I make bone broth. I've done that.
Here's the thing though.
But wait, then I'm drinking the water.
Yeah, you're supposed to get rid of. Yeah, that's the thing. When people say, "Oh, I make mushroom soup," I'm like, "Okay, well, you want to boil the mushrooms, throw away the water, and then do what you want with the mushroom, right?" Like what you
all
just said.
All mushrooms or just the button mushrooms? White
I'm
ones.
pretty sure I would do it personally with all mushrooms, but Ray's only talked about white. And
Two hours.
I've done it
Why?
before, but
Why?
I forget the actual toxin name. You should ask Andrew though, because we were just talking about this right before this we started recording. But and she sent me a PubMed link to the actual chemical. But there's this toxin, and that's why Ray always said don't eat mushrooms for like decades. He said don't eat mushrooms, but then he said, okay, I'm changing my mind because I figured out when you boil the mushrooms for 2 to 4 hours, you reduce this toxin a lot, and a lot of it, is in the water. And he says put on the fan, so even
What?
the
You're
steam
scaring
from the boil is like
me.
it's getting soaked up by the fan, right? Or the on the stovetop. So he goes, you boil those mushrooms 2 to 4 hours. I think Kate Deering said if you need to, just do it for 30 minutes. So that's
I'm
pretty.
doing for 5 minutes. I'm
Five
so
minutes. Yeah,
impressed
I
with
would do it way
myself.
more than five. But yeah, I think this is what I do. And people might be freaking out, but this is way easier. I boil a whole bunch of white button mushrooms for 2 to 4 hours.
Do
But
you
again,
slice them?
you can. It makes it. I think if you slice them, you could probably cut that time down. Like 30 minutes is way more reasonable if they're sliced mushrooms, but sometimes I don't. But let's say you 2 to 4 hours, full white button mushrooms, lots of them. Once you're done and you discard the black water, you can put those mushrooms in the fridge for up to 1 week. So you can make a week's worth of mushrooms in 1 day. And you can take some mushrooms out and saute them and put them on some food or just eat them like that. You can make a mushroom soup 1 day, right? You don't need to boil the mushrooms for 4 hours every day. You can boil all of them and keep them for a week. That's what a lot of people do. That's what I do. But if you just want to do a small batch, I mean, got 2 hours to kill. You can
Oh
boil
my
them. Yeah.
goodness, I'm in
But I
shock.
think 5 minutes is too
So that's
small.
also a lot of water because if you're boiling it and you're
Oh,
doing it for
yeah.
2 to 4 hours, you're having to continually add
Well,
water.
I mean, I think it's more like a
A
simmer,
slow
a low
simmer.
boil. But you're right. You definitely need a large quantity of water.
Oh
So,
man,
but
okay, well.
they work very similarly to the carrots. They're probably even better because mushrooms are very antimicrobial, like way more than the carrot is. They're less of a broom than the carrot, but if you have SIBO, I think it's a great thing to do these mushrooms, especially if you boil the mushrooms, get rid of the water, and then saute them in an antimicrobial thing like a coconut oil and put salt on them. Like that's basically the raw, I mean the boiled mushrooms sauteed salad instead of the
Yeah.
coconut oil salad.
What if you took the boiled mushrooms, sauteed them in coconut oil, and then put them over shredded carrots with a little bit of vinegar?
Oh my gosh. Okay, well that's the perfect Ray Pete. That should be the Ray Pete's some name for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that'll be
Okay.
perfect. But
So
that's important. Yeah.
I
It's important.
wonder, what he would say about fermented carrots.
I think Andrew's a fan of those. I don't know about Ray. I'm not sure he likes fermentation just because he's a really really doesn't like lactic acid, so he doesn't like lactic acid fermentation. But who knows what he thinks about fermentation in general? I don't know.
Yeah.
I know he's not a fan of beer. He said
Oh.
in one really old newsletter, he said like his friend gave him really really cool beer, like type of beer that he liked, and he would drink it throughout the summer. But then he started getting moles. He thinks it's because of the estrogen that increased from the beer.
Really?
He stopped drinking the beer because he was like having little moles growing on him.
Does he drink any alcohol, do you know?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But he did say a very small amount of alcohol can have an anti-lipofuscin effect, an anti, age spot effect.
Yeah,
He did say
probably not much
that.
at all, though.
Someone was like, oh, how much? He said some amount of alcohol, and someone said, oh, how much would that be? Like a glass of wine? He's like, oh, no, a quarter glass of wine.
Oh
Something like
my
that.
goodness.
Yeah, but
I don't belong on this planet. I'm not from this planet, for sure.
But I mean,
I don't work on this planet.
I think alcohol's fine. I don't think
Broken.
Ray's like excessively talked to. I know Georgie drinks a lot, so you can
Yes,
ask him. He drinks. Yeah, I've heard him multiple times talk about I think he said he went back to Bulgaria and had like a competition with his friends who could drink most beer, and he had
Oh
like,
my goodness.
yeah. I mean, I could be misremembering, but ask him about that. Maybe
That's funny.
he'll share the story, but.
I've really learned a lot. I always learn so much from Constantine. I think he is a kid genius, although he's not really a kid anymore. I wonder if that bugs him that I say kid genius. It's just incredible. It sheds light on a lot of what we all deal with, this endotoxin business. But I'm going to have him back again so that we can talk about carbohydrates and people who are pre-diabetic and how this repeat business talks about drinking orange juice and eat and drinking dairy and eating fruit and all of these pre-diabetics or people that deal with insulin resistance or diabetics are like, he's crazy. So Constantine's going to come back and we're going to talk about that at length, and I'm excited to talk about that because there's a lot of that stuff I don't know about. Yes, it's true, friends. I don't know everything. In fact, I don't know that much at all. But that's why I have guests on who do. So we talked about a few really important things in this podcast that I thought I would bring up again, just to remind you about the spore-based probiotics and how important they are to help heal or to help curb the endotoxin. Just Thrive sells a spore-based probiotic, but they also have an incredible prebiotic that is really good. And people who have really difficult time with prebiotics, this stuff is incredible. I have a ton of clients that are on it that have SIBO, and they do great with this prebiotic and the spore-based probiotic. In fact, Kiran Krishnan even goes as far as to say that people who have SIBO and SIFO should be on these spore-based probiotics and prebiotic. And then we also talked about the MediClay from Premier Research Labs, which is an incredible binder that helps to be like a broom through the gut that you can take when you are out to dinner and you're having, takeout food and you're worried about whatever they put in the food, or you're eating commercially raised produce, or anything that's just not as high quality as you would normally like to have. MediClay is incredible. If you are traveling and you get food poisoning, or you don't feel well, or you drank the tap water, or you went for a swim in the Ganges, or whatever, the MediClay is so good for that. It's excellent, and it helps actually give you energy too. And I'm not really sure how that works, but that's what it does. And so they also have a really good digest. And Constantine talked about all the ASEs, right? The ASEs that help us digest things, like the digestive enzymes, like amylase, protease, sucralase, all the ASEs, lipase. Those are digestive enzymes. We make a lot of them, but a lot of them are in our food that we eat. And then when you cook it, they kind of get damaged. And so, it's nice to be able to take digestive enzymes so that you can help to break down the foods. And no, it's not true. If you take digestive enzymes, it does not stop your body from producing its own. Usually, you're not making your own, and that's why you need them. So, but it doesn't stop your body from making them. So that product's called Digest, and then of course HCL. Everybody who knows me for all these years knows that I'm a huge fan of taking HCL and the MediClay. All those are great products from Premier Research Labs, and all that information is in the show notes, along with a 30% coupon code for PRL. So if you know PRL, you know how high quality their stuff is. Their B vitamins, their liquid B vitamins are like $75 for a bottle. 30% off, incredible. And then there's a 20% off coupon for the spore-based probiotics and prebiotics. And Just Thrive has a lot of really good stuff too. Like they have a K2 that's really good. So yeah, definitely take advantage of those coupons. And thank you so much for joining us. And we'll talk to you soon. Yay!